You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, September 25th, 2014. My name's Matt Binder, and this is the award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, on today's program, professor, writer, Vijay Prashad, he's going to give us a bottom-up view of the war that's been launched against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, what it says about where we are, what it says about the international system, the strategy that's being pursued, and the experience on the ground. Also, on today's program...
We will be discussing the latest news that has broken in the case of John Crawford, the young unarmed black man who was shot by police in Walmart for holding a BB gun, toy gun. The surveillance video has been released to the public, and it's certainly depressing.
It's enraged.
Not shocking what you're going to hear and what you will see in the YouTube version clip of this segment, but depressing and disgusting, but sadly not shocking.
Also, Fox News uses an opportunity to interview Dinesh D'Souza before he goes off to serve his sentence for campaign finance violations to run an infomercial for his book. And Republicans have an excellent new campaign strategy to bring back women voters, literally to bring them away from President Obama. You'll see what I mean when we play that ad. It's ridiculous.
The best is that we also have something that combines those two stories, where we have Fox News hosts saying the most horrible things they could possibly think of about a woman air fighter.
Woman fighter pilot from United Arab Emirates.
It's just amazing.
It's pretty funny.
Funny and amazing
and depressing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little overcast today. It depends what kind of mood I'm in. Sometimes I'm in a more, haha, that's hilarious, ridiculous, and disgusting. Today it's a little bit more like, oh, God, really? But anyways, before we get to all of that,
we have some news that just broke today.
Some news, yeah, that, as Matt said, just broke today. Attorney General Eric Holder's stepping down. By all accounts, this is what he wanted. Excuse me, folks.
Just shut down every single – just close his stuff.
Sam
has 100 tabs open, never closes them, and then when we come in the next day, all the videos he had opened and everything else just starts automatically playing.
It's tough. Anyway, let me reset that. I apologize. So anyways, Attorney General Eric Holder is stepping down. By all accounts, it's his decision. The administration, Obama, President Obama, was happy to have him stay through the rest of the term and serve a full 8 years. And that makes sense. They've stuck with Holder through controversies, some controversies that were drummed up in nonsense by Republicans like Fast and Furious, and other things where Holder was frankly complicit in some incredibly problematic administration policies. And obviously there's no reason why they'd want him to go for being complicit in their wrongheaded policy initiatives. He's the first African-American attorney general. And I think it's really – it's not often – in public life that you can feel as fully ambivalent about somebody as I feel about Eric Holder. I think his record on civil rights, his push to reform sentencing laws, his honesty about race, calling us a nation of cowards several years ago, created a huge backlash. But there's no doubt that, of course, we are when we talk about race. And we see every day that denying the reality of racism is not just delusional and complacent. It sets a context for the shooting of John Crawford, for systemic biases in policing, systemic biases in job hiring, the reality and systemic nature of racism and classism and all the rest is, of course, a reality of today's world. And Eric Holder used his position pretty well in that regard and pretty unflinchingly. It didn't work, but he was certainly someone who, at least in the beginning of the administration, was very adamant about returning, trying Guantanamo subjects in the United States off of Guantanamo in civilian courts. That didn't end up working, but he fought the fight internally for that. And then the other thing is that there's no doubt that a very large reason that he has been so slammed and harassed by Republicans is that, you know, particularly maybe in the first couple of years of the administration, when they felt some need to not fully unleash on President Obama, Eric Holder, as another black senior official, was the kind of absorbing these body blows aimed at President Obama, essentially, that couldn't be aimed in the same way. Now, that said, Eric Holder's record on Wall Street and the financial industry is pathetic. Criminal accountability for the financial sector is not just about retribution and making us feel better. It's literally about the future safety and security of the American economy, because not holding criminal accountability and not holding a completely failed institutional structure that wiped out the American economy and hurt the global economy profoundly, not holding it to account obviously sets the stage for future events like this. Eric Holder failed in that regard, and the administration failed. Also, Eric Holder obviously was a prime a shaper of administration policies on things like targeted killings and the drone program, which we're going to live with in terms of the really just kind of extraordinary steps that the U.S. government takes in terms of who can be killed, the process around which they can be killed. And Eric Holder will have that on his legacy as well. So, look, I think first African-American attorney general, very good record on civil rights, did some real work, even within the last weeks has announced new initiatives that are excellent on criminal sentencing, how prosecutors talk to defendants. Very, very good impulses. And of course, now in the last couple of weeks, too, actually attempted to do a little bit more Wall Street accountability. But the reality of his record is that ambiguity.
It's a little bit too late.
I put it even more strongly. I mean, it's almost a joke after, you know, the game has been settled, basically. I mean, yes, too little too late is an understatement. But a genuinely ambiguous record. And I think, again, like with President Obama, some of the vitriol and the attacks on him, I'm very mindful of the racial context of them and just the reality of who he was and what his appointment signified. So anyways, that's Eric Holder. Anything to add to that?
I think you wrapped the Eric Holder. You know, I wonder what his
wrap it up.
I do wonder what his, we always talk about, you know, Obama's legacy. I do wonder what his whether people will remember his civil rights record or whether people will remember all his failings. I do applaud him for his strong civil rights stances. I just don't think we've seen enough of that, and I'm glad someone, Attorney General of all people too, did have that stance and take these things the way he took them, but
no doubt about it.
But everything else,
All right. Well, that's Eric Holder. We're gonna, It's genuinely ambiguous.
How do you add when Michael goes on one of his rants where he pretty much wraps up everything you need to know? I mean, he is the guy who does the everything you need to know in 3 minute segment.
Everything you need to know guy.
Michael's specialty is taking it all, summarizing it, and leaving you nothing.
Oh. My relentless synthesizer.
And I do say that. In a complimentary fashion.
Thanks, man. All right. We will be right back with Vijay Prashad. Oh, and of course, happy Jewish New Year to everybody.
Happy New Year. Great
celebration last night. We got some music for you.
Yeah, we have a little bit of special Rosh Hashanah music.
All right. We'll be right back.
Birthday of creation, yeah. All ends with beginnings. What keeps the planet spinning? The force from the beginning.
We've come so far to give up who we are. So let's raise the bar.
The present rich with meaning. The future is yours for choosing. The shofar we are hearing. Apples dipped in honey.
We make mistakes. Start anew. We can change. Take stock. Suit your soul. Shine out the bulb. Time to grow.
We are back on the Majority Report.
My name is Michael Brooks. Joining us now, Vijay Prashad. He's a professor at Trinity College and a writer for Frontline Magazine. Vijay, great to have you on. How are you?
My pleasure. Thank you. I'm great.
So I just really briefly, before we get to the broader conversation that we're going to have about the Middle East, President Obama's speech at the UN, I had some news for you that apparently you're just hearing that Attorney General Eric Holder is stepping down, and I just wanted to get your sort of quick reaction to that.
I think it's great news. Eric Holder is the most interesting person in the Obama administration.
Right.
I mean, he's the head of the Justice Department who believes that America is incarcerating too many people.
Yes.
It's, let him go out and speak even more clearly and openly.
Yeah, that's right. No, there's a real ambiguity in his record because he has been actually very good on a lot of really key issues. And then on Wall Street and on other areas, he's, been.
But Ferguson, there were two politicians on Ferguson that I was very impressed by. One was him. Mm-hmm. I think he just said it straight.
Definitely.
He said what everybody believes. And the other was Deval Patrick of Massachusetts.
Yes.
Who basically said, I'm sick of reading in the newspapers about unarmed young black men being shot.
Right.
I mean, could you have put it any plainer than that?
Right. No, exactly. And I actually remember one time, and I'll bring it back in a moment, but I remember one time watching Deval Patrick. I don't remember who asked him this question, but somebody, some type of, maybe it was Bill Maher or somebody like that, said, hey, do you think that if you had become the first African-American president, or the second African-American president for that matter, would you have the patience that President Obama has for all of the subtle and not so subtle racism that's thrown your way? And I remember Deval Patrick just said, no. No. He didn't have anything more to add to it. So I'm very, very happy to have you on because I think that there is a lot to place into context with what's happening over the last several weeks. I want to start and we'll work backwards from President Obama's address to the United Nations. I think that it was a very interesting address, and I think that it's, you know, it's worth noting that he's definitely, certainly for that audience, he's trying to situate the strikes in Syria and Iraq in the context of some type of at least articulation of a liberal international order, and connecting it with things that, you know, global warming, Ebola, these kind of more generalized threats and problems that there is a need for international coordination on. I want to get your impression of that speech, who he was speaking to, the vision he was articulating, and then work it backwards from that. What are the problems?
Well, look, I think all the issues, including the question of, you know, terrorism,
right,
are in need of global handling or
yes,
some kind of international cooperation. I mean, I think it's now by now basically a cliche to say that there are some things called global problems, and these global problems require global solutions. So in that sense, you know, I think he was speaking toward that cliche. And I was not that impressed with that general, you know, outlook. I mean, it's true, you're right. There's a liberal internationalism that claims this to be a hallmark piece of their view of the world, you know, that they see, as it were, these global problems that need liberal intervention in a certain way. But, you know, it's not like people who come to the UN General Assembly disagree with that. I mean, the reason they take the United Nations seriously is because they accept the premise that you cannot actually unilaterally or even sometimes regionally deal with a problem.
Right.
So that is there, and it's true. And I think that I would not allow President Obama to actually take that important principle and suborn it to the heritage of liberal internationalism. I think it's a much broader vision that's rooted in the UN Charter, and that's where it belongs. It's not the property of one ideological camp or another. It's a property of the UN Charter. Everybody agrees to that. So that's there. I was, of course, impressed by, again, the way he put things together and his style. You know, there's no question that, you know, when Mr. Obama says something like, it can't just be rhetoric, there has to be action, you don't actually feel like he's being, you know, that there's a kind of irony there. Because it is really beautiful rhetoric. And the action is kind of weird compared to the vision he puts out there.
Mm-hmm.
You don't think that because you actually think that he's sincere.
Right.
And he's lucky that he can command sincerity for policies that don't deserve, I think, that accolade. You know, I don't think I should see his speech as a sincere speech. You know, that was the advantage of Mr. Bush, who couldn't command sincerity. And therefore, people didn't believe what he was saying,
mm-hmm,
and said, no, he's going to be much more vicious than what he's proposing. Whereas Mr. Obama is able to muddy the waters, and I think that is his really great talent.
His really great talent is muddying the waters. Okay, so what? I guess then let's go more deeply into that. What waters is he muddying? And I think that partially here what we have to do is, again, it seems like every, you know, obviously the rise of this IS, of ISIS, and the notion that Iraq and the experience, you know, that Iraq is imploding on some level. Syria has gone from being a humanitarian crisis, civil war, to having these certainly broader, or it's become more apparent all of the regional implications of it. And it seems like, and I know that you've written about this and spoken about this, that obviously a significant factor here is that the conflict between Shia and Sunni, the rise of more ethnic, religious-based politics, and the lessening of national identity or even post-national identity is sort of driving this. Now, obviously we set the context for this somewhat with the invasion of Iraq, and our allies like Saudi Arabia set the context by funding this sort of thing. But how do you balance, you know, it seems, again, we're okay, so we're going to go and address the symptom to a problem that we had a great deal in causing. Through this approach, are we generating a whole new set of problems? But then by that same token, how do you actually start to, from a policy perspective, if President Obama's great rhetoric was matched by great policy, what would those policies look like? I guess is that that's a sort of long road to the question I'm trying to get to.
No, it's a tough this is a tough question to answer. Yeah. And let me say that it's difficult for two reasons. One is, if you go back to what, you know, you said there's a difference between the cause and the symptom. And it's true that the previous speech that President Obama delivered on September 10th, which announced, you know, a kind of strategy for dealing with the Islamic State, was entirely a speech about symptoms.
Right.
You know, they have emerged, we're going to bomb them, we're going to prevent them from having safe havens. The pabulum, basically, of American presidential addresses about terrorism. You know, this could have been found in a White House printer with a date stamp 2005.
Right.
And he could have read it out and it would have seemed fresh to us, because we forget that basically it's the same speech that you've heard, you know, since maybe actually even the 1990s. But set that aside.
Right.
The question of causes and symptoms is a long-term problem for policy making, you know, whether it's in questions of climate change or questions of you know, joblessness for people. Politicians in these short-term amnesiac democracies like to solve symptoms and don't really ever get to the cause. So it's not just about terrorism.
Sure.
But the specific question here that I think is important is so President Obama delivers, you know, an interesting address talking about the conflict in the Middle East, and then he distances the conflict from one particular event and locates it elsewhere. Or rather, he distances it from two events and then locates it elsewhere. He very cleverly distances the emergence of the Islamic State and the turmoil, really, from Libya, which he mentions only once, from Libya to Iraq. He distances it from the Israel-Palestine conflict at the end of the speech. You know, he says that, you know, however bad the problems are in Iraq, Syria, and Libya, it should cure you of the illusions, you know, is the phrase he uses, to link it to Israel and Palestine. So it has nothing to do with Israel and Palestine. That was one conflict that he's distanced what's happening from. The other one was from the Iraq war. You know, he doesn't locate this at all in the Iraq war. And what he does is, and this is the neoconservative Barack Obama, he locates the problem in the Shia-Sunni conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is interesting, because this is something that is new for him. And I was surprised in his earlier speeches since August, when he started to use the language of Shia and Sunni, you know, in a commonplace way. And he has to understand that he's talking in these terms to a public that doesn't know what he's actually referring to, except to assume that he's saying this is a problem inside the House of Islam itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's its problem. It goes back to the 7th century. It has nothing to do with us. You know, we are innocent of their problem.
And that's the classic neocon argument, right? Right.
That is the exact neoconservative argument. And that is why I think now President Obama is not actually a liberal in his view of this conflict. He is actually a neoconservative. And so why is this significant? And is this really a Sunni-Shia conflict? I mean, these are important questions. Why is it significant? It's significant because in the middle, I mean, this is precisely how Saudi Arabia, since 1962, has seen its role in the region. You know, before the 1960s, there was an emergent Arab national sentiment, you know, that was carried through in the process of the Egyptian Revolution in 1952, that was very important in Iraq in 58 when Brigadier Qasim overthrows the king. So Arab nationalism had secured itself as the hegemonic or dominant voice of Arab sentiment and aspiration. And the Saudis in 1962 create a group called the World Muslim League, where they begin to push a very hard sectarian position against not only Arab nationalism, but increasingly, you know, to push forward their view of Islam. you know, which is legitimate. I mean, I'm not one of those that believes that there's a real Islam and a not a real Islam or a real Christianity. You know, religious traditions need to own everything that they have, the good, the bad, the ugly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what the worst kind of people in a religious tradition say. They start claiming that others are apostates. And then liberals turn around and say, no, you are the real apostate, you know.
Right.
I mean, if you guys are religious, you guys deal with all of your stuff, you know. So anyway, the Saudis come in and they start this language of Shia and Sunni in the modern era. You know, I mean, you'll recall that right through the 1950s, in most of the Arab world, the issue of Shia and Sunni had been put on mute, you know. And in fact, religion was on mute because some of the leading Arab nationalist intellectuals are Christians.
Right.
And it's a surprise to people today in the Arab world when you mention to them that the people in the Nahda movement, the Renaissance in the 19th century, many of the leaders of Arab nationalism, including Michel Aflaq, the leading intellectual of the Ba'ath movement,
right,
were Christians.
Right.
You know, it's a surprise to people. They don't, you know, imagine that. So one, that this is a history of power struggle against a tide of anti-monarchy, you know, that produces the Shia-Sunni dialogue, and it's rooted in Saudi Arabia. That's where it comes from. The second issue, is this really a Shia-Sunni dispute today? I mean, that covers over a very obvious issue, which is that, well, it is that, of course, to some extent, but it's really a power struggle between two or three major powers in the region.
Right.
Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Iran.
Right.
And unless you come to the politics of what's going on, it's too easy to just name this as a sectarian struggle.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And then that raises again a whole other set of questions that it doesn't seem like there's an appetite for dealing with in terms of that regional conflict. Before we get to that, though, I want you to speak. I know you do a lot of work on Libya. Libya is sort of not in the center of a lot of conversations about this. I mean, we basically seem like in a most media discourse, so Gaddafi was this crazy, horrible guy in the 80s, 90s, that somehow for a couple of years in the early part of the last decade, he was this eccentric guy who brought his tent to different Western capitals and we could do oil deals with him. Then he was about to slaughter a bunch of people, and all of a sudden we took him out. And then Benghazi. And, of course, we all know, you know, Benghazi is the greatest terrorist event in global history, according to some people. But and that's really basically it. But you have been very focused on the disintegration of Libya and how that very particular dynamic is playing out and affecting the situation as well. So I'd like you to speak to Libya and get to that as part of the context for what we're talking about. And also as a way of obviously speaking to additional U.S. or Western action in the region.
Well, just to pick up from President Obama, as I mentioned, he mentioned Libya only once. And that was in the context of saying that what's happening from Libya to Syria and Iraq has nothing to do with Israel and Palestine. Mm-hmm. So he didn't directly talk about Libya. You know, it's interesting that in 2011, in March, there was hyperventilation in the Obama administration about needing to seek UN Security Council authorization to conduct via NATO airstrikes in Libya. And there was first a push to pass UN Resolution 1970, which had an arms embargo against Libya. And then because that was not sufficient for a military raid, they then pushed through the Arab League. They got the Saudis, made a very interesting deal with the Saudis. The Saudis brought their people on board, all the Gulf Arab states. They got an Arab League supporting resolution, which then came to the UN and was passed as UN Resolution 1973, which allowed the NATO attack on Libya. This deal was interesting because at the night that the UN resolution passed, Saudi troops entered Bahrain and crushed the uprising in Bahrain.
Right.
You know, that was really the deal. We'll give you Libya, but you have to give us Bahrain. And
right.
Saudis then were able to basically massacre people in Bahrain, and there was no media to cover it. You know, Al Jazeera was expelled, everybody was thrown out. So now, this was an incredible push to go to the UN to get authorization. On Syria, the United States unilaterally bombed in Syria. There was no bother for any UN permission, you know, direct resolution allowing, because they knew they won't get it anymore. You know, they hoodwinked the Russians and Chinese, who have regretted it, and India and Brazil, countries that abstained, who would have voted no, and South Africa, which was arm-twisted to vote yes for the Libya resolution. So the appetite in the Security Council for giving the United States permission to do this in Syria was actually, you know, it was taken out through the Libya experience. After NATO bombed Libya, it precipitated the utter collapse of the Libyan state. I mean, in Libya, you didn't need a Paul Bremer to show up and pass order number one, which was basically the firing of all, you know, state officials, and order number two, which was disbanding the army. You know, Bremer had to do that in Iraq.
So Libya just skipped Bremer, ruining everything, and went
direct. Yeah, Libya was a fragile country, and the bombing basically allowed, because there was no U.S. occupation or NATO occupation, it allowed the small bunches of, you know, militia groups to basically seize sections of the country. You know, that's the two big differences. A much more fragile country than Iraq, and because there was no singular occupying power, the country was just handed over on a plate to chaos. And by the way, again, before the Libya bombing, there was no Al-Qaeda inside Libya. There was a group called the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which wanted to overthrow Mr. Gaddafi since the 1980s. Its leadership had been expelled from Libya. Some of them subsequently went to Afghanistan, like Mr. Belhaj, became members of Al-Qaeda, and now, of course, Mr. Belhaj is a major leader in Tripoli. But this is not even, he doesn't consider himself Al-Qaeda in Libya. After the destruction of the society in Benghazi, a group is formed in 2012, called Ansar al-Sharia, which you hear about now a fair amount.
Yeah.
But you see, there was no Ansar al-Sharia before the NATO bombing, just as in Iraq, there was no Al-Qaeda of Iraq before the Iraq war. You know, there was a small pocket of jihadis, but they had largely been expelled. The leader of Al-Qaeda of Iraq was a Jordanian, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who came from Jordan. He's not Iraqi. So, you know, the thing is, these are very, very clear warning histories about what you do when you try to utilize massive air power without having forces on the ground that support you, that can actually produce a new monopoly over violence. And in Syria, U.S. policy is mimicking U.S. policy in Libya without a U.N. resolution. Mm-hmm. You know, and therefore, Syria is not going to turn out like Iraq, worse. It's going to be like Libya. But its geography is such that it is going to be much more dangerous than the Libyan outcome, which is pretty damn dangerous itself.
And so, and I guess I just to sort of fill it in, I mean, the practical upshot of chaos is basically Libya is just sort of essentially just competing militia groups, essentially sort of fighting for slices of geography and neighborhoods, essentially.
And and not able to fight and hold. I mean,
and not able to fight and hold. Yeah,
yeah, that's the kicker. If you fight, hold, and then you know you create your enclave, that's one thing. But they are constantly fighting. You know, and different power groups are constantly trying to, marginalize others. And what this is doing, of course, is in this instability, you know, there are two outcomes of it. One. You see, so you have, for instance, the French enter. You know, the French have played a very poor game over the last 10 years. The French entered to do a bombing raid in Mali. And you see, again, what does aerial bombardment do? Aerial bombardment actually doesn't destroy a mobile and tentacular, you know, like the tentacle-like terrorist organization. It just shifts it. So
right.
When the French bombed northern Mali, the group in northern Mali moved across the border into Algeria, and you remember they came and captured an energy plant and held the plant captive, and then they exchanged for hostages. But they moved in very large numbers into southern Libya. So, you know, aerial bombardment simply shifts the geography because these groups don't sit there waiting to be killed. You know, they move. And so one of the consequences of chaos in Libya is it has enabled groups that have been taking fire elsewhere to seek shelter inside Libya. Second consequence is it has seriously threatened at least two of the three neighbors, Algeria and Tunisia. Tunisia is a country that doesn't deserve to be threatened. Because of all the countries in the Arab Spring, it has had the best outcome possible.
Right.
You know, the Tunisians have actually written their own constitution through a very torturous process. It was filled with negotiations and concessions. You know, it's not the greatest constitution in the world because it's filled with concessions. But they have succeeded in an incredible way. And, I mean, it doesn't get enough press. You know, I'm surprised. I would have imagined the president could have had his closing, praising the Tunisian example. You know, instead of saying, look, in my presidency, I bombed seven countries and they're all Muslim countries, and allowing a kind of Islamophobia, an incipient Islamophobia, to remain at the table. Why not talk about Tunisia, an incredible success, but it's threatened now by the major instability on the Libya-Tunisia border.
So that's really illustrative that if Syria follows a trajectory of Libya, that could really be truly catastrophic. Let's get back to, you talked about Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Turkey. Now, I think a lot of people have some sense very practically, Syria as an example has clearly been some type of proxy conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Now, Turkey occupies a very interesting position here, and I want you to talk about how these three players sort of go out. Because it seems in Saudi Arabia that even as they have supported groups in very similar vein to ISIS, and maybe did even support people associated with ISIS at some point, they are very concerned about ISIS, and that seems quite genuine, and they're, it's close to home for them, so therefore they're very concerned about it. Obviously, Iran is going to be very opposed to a group like ISIS. Now, Turkey, which has, still has fairly functioning democracy, is a member of NATO. It's governed by an Islamic party, but an Islamic party that has fashioned itself as almost more of a, Islamic version of a European Christian Democrat party. They, in some ways, have been by far the most ambivalent about their role in containing ISIS and these groups. So when you look at the terrain of these, of the interplay between these three countries and how it relates to actually figuring out how to actually contain and figure out these groups in a way that's smart and durable, what are the takeaways from what are these three countries aiming at, and what's the best approach for dealing with those dynamics?
Yeah, this is the big question. I mean, let's leave Saudi Arabia and Iran for a second, because those are the two most important countries for the long-term health of the area. Turkey is a fascinating country. I mean, it's one of my favorite countries. It's a great place. It's a very complicated society. This current government that is ruling in Ankara has a very curious approach to the Middle East. You know, earlier, the current prime minister, Mr. Davutoglu, was considered to be the founder of a school of thought called Neo-Ottomanism.
Right.
I thought that term was not right. It's actually a kind of pan-Islamism. You know, they see themselves as a kind of heirs to a kind of educated Sunni Islam, very much like the Muslim Brotherhood. And therefore, there has been a kind of, an attachment to that ideological stream, which is why frequently Qatar and Turkey will find themselves on the same side of arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a kind of a brotherhood approach to the region. Where Islam has to have an important place in government, professionals and technocrats need to have the driver's seat, etc. It's interesting, when the Erdogan government was, in its early phase, they had very close links with the Assad regime. And in fact, some of the boom in Turkey came from the massive neoliberal project in Syria, where Turkish construction companies came in, Turkish banks like the Halk Bank and others entered into the Syrian market, and they were able to come very close in terms of business relations. Fascinatingly, it seems that underneath all that, there had been a very strong antipathy to the secular kind of Ba'athism of the Assad regime. this had to have been there. The vehemence of Mr. Erdogan's speeches, since 2011 against Assad and the Assad regime is quite characteristic of some kind of, you know, underlying anger with the ideology of the government. And then Mr. Davutoglu, who, you know, comes off as a political science prof, which he was, he used extremely sectarian language in his speeches, you know, about the Shia, about the Alawites, you know, the community from which Mr. Assad hails. Very strange and interesting language that I personally didn't expect to hear, you know, publicly. So Turkey took an advanced position for the overthrow of the Assad government before many other people. And I was talking to a Kurdish official recently who was on the record on a number of things, but he told me something I thought amusing off the record. Basically, it was, he said, that Turkey started seeing these jihadi groups in the same way as Pakistan saw the Taliban, as a way to have a kind of forward policy in Syria and to influence events in Syria with a level of deniability. You know, you won't send in Turkish troops, you won't send in Turkish planes, but they allowed the border to be porous, and, you know, they have since allowed various fighters, including Nusra fighters, ISIS fighters, to come back across the border to Turkish hospitals. You know, this has been reasonably well documented. And anybody who'd been to Kilis or Mardin or others would have seen these fighters stream across the border, you know. When we were told that Azaz was closed, it was not closed to these people. Mm. And it should be noted that when Steve Sotloff crossed, you know, the second man journalist to be beheaded, Sotloff crossed at Kilis into, at Azaz. And it was at a time when, you know, everybody was saying that right across the border are Islamist groups who are, you know, very dangerous. They've been going back and forth. So Turkey has played an odd role, and until even yesterday, both the Prime Minister and President, Davutoglu and Erdogan, have said publicly that they don't consider the Islamic State as a terrorist organization, but a group with terrorist tendencies, you know, things like that. And they also said that the biggest terrorist is actually the Assad government. And the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood also refused to target the Islamic State as the primary enemy, saying they would only back the American mission if the first American bullet was fired into Bashar al-Assad's skull. Ah. And similar kind of ideas come from Turkey. So the Turkish government has actually been the least willing to commit to any kind of assault on ISIS. They're directly. In fact, yesterday Mr. Erdogan's speech was very strong in defending the Turkish policy, saying, you know, because the West allowed this civil war to continue, it has created, it allowed Mr. Assad to create terrorism in Syria. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, that's really astonishing. I mean, given Turkey's traditional role and where they sit in the world, and it's also, I mean, you know, it's a slightly different tack, but it's fascinating to me that, certain secular Turks had thought very conspiratorially about this government. I'm very critical of the Erdogan government, but it's fascinating to watch as they've dealt with a group like ISIS to see that, you know, not that the sort of really extravagant conspiracies are validated about them, but that their thinking on these issues does go in a more radical and problematic direction than many, I think, had realized, who were, you know, attempting to be somewhat broad-minded or think a little bit more systemically about where they were coming from. As we move towards the end of this conversation, I mean, so you've said, look, because aerial bombardments really ultimately and it's quite obvious, they're designed in a certain sense, if you're attacking a state, that is much more logical. There's an infrastructure, there's a military infrastructure you can attack. When you're dealing with, you know, cellular network organizations, they can move and shift and blend into populations. And then, of course, the whole conversation that's been astonishingly absent from this whole thing has been the toll on civilian populations ever since these operations have begun. But as you look on the ground in terms of groups that can legitimately have a claim for power, for the use of force, for, frankly, who we should be thinking in some respects about backing, I guess, besides the Kurds, which I guess are a pretty obvious candidate for this sort of thing. I mean, what is the kind of ground up strategy that could actually be intelligently supported to halt ISIS, as an example?
The very fact that the United States government, which has been attempting to train and create a moderate force in its base in eastern Jordan, and attempting to create a moderate force through the Free Syrian Army with cash disbursements, over the last 3 years and has failed, should demonstrate to a rational person that this is not a useful strategy.
Right.
I mean, currently, this is a shell game. The United States, amazingly, has outsourced the creation of a moderate opposition to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's track record in Syria is the following. It has a group that it has created called Jaish al-Islam,
right,
led by Mr. Zahran Alush, who is on record having conducted sectarian killings in Damascus and elsewhere against people who are, Christian, Shia, Alawite, Druze, Ismaili, etc. So, it demonstrates to you when somebody like Samantha Power can go on American television and say that we need to create a moderate political force, we need to create a moderate military force in order to have a political solution in Syria. That's what she said yesterday. If you want to have a political solution in Syria, you can have it today, because the Assad government is incredibly weakened by the civil war, and there could be new currents that come in to make a big deal. A big deal needs to be created right now. You don't need to try to pretend to create a moderate force. That's simply a way to not sell out the opposition and to be then have a reputation of not being trusted when you back a revolution against or an uprising or whatever it is against a country. America right now is trying to protect its reputation. The Syrian situation or even ISIS is not at the head of their thinking.
Right. Well, Vijay Prashad, that makes perfect sense. It's enlightening and disturbing. And I'm actually thinking, as you sort of elucidate this in a strange way, and I would never make this direct comparison because I do think President Obama is much more, a significantly more appealing leader and more sophisticated thinker. But in some ways, you've almost seen this progress of Barack Obama almost really becoming a Tony Blair-like figure. And that's in terms of some of his thinking about the region. And that's not nice to contemplate. But I really, really appreciate your time.
That's a scary comparison.
yeah, it is. It unsettled my stomach as I thought of it. But I nonetheless thought it was worth sharing. I really appreciate your time, Professor. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thanks a lot, Mikey.
Yeah. Bye-bye. All right, folks, we went a little bit long there, but there's just so much to get through with Vijay Prashad. He's brilliant, and he's one of those guys, agree or disagree, he's like, there's a handful of people that you really need to be reading and listening to right now, and he's definitely one of them. So excellent to have him on.
I've been covering the shooting of John Crawford in an Ohio Walmart from the very first time I heard of it. You can go there. I have on our YouTube channel, where you can find that our coverage of it has been lengthy and detailed. I've made sure to give every single bit of information I could find, whether it's from articles, whether it's from on the ground accounts, whether it's from the family and the lawyer of John Crawford. And this case to me has been astonishing that the media hasn't covered this more. And just yesterday, an Ohio grand jury decided that the two police officers who killed John Crawford in August would not be charged. Jeez. Now, for those of you who need a quick refresher, John Crawford went into a Walmart. He saw a BB gun. Some call it a toy. Others say it is a hunting for small game, but it cannot harm a person type rifle. He saw one. He picked it up, and he walked around to the store with it. Now, the surveillance video was originally not released, And when you see it, which you will because it now is released, you will see it in this video if you're watching this on YouTube, and I will describe it for our podcast listeners as we play it. You will see why they did not want this video released. Because the public outcry before the grand jury made their decision to not charge these police officers would have undoubtedly been so big, I think the decision might have been slightly different. What you will see is a young, unarmed black man entering a Walmart, walking over to an aisle, picking up an unpackaged, loose BB gun, walking around the store, majority of the time, the end of the BB gun is pointed down. Sometimes he's swinging it, pointing it slightly at products on the shelf. Never at an individual. I would like to point this out. Because the guy who called the police, Ronald Ritchie, specifically said he was going around pointing it at children, pointing it at other customers, threatening them. He said that Crawford was pointing it at people. And he was loading the gun right now. And it looked like he was going out violently. This was said by Ronald Ritchie and his girlfriend, who both were on the phone with police following John Crawford. Remember now, as I previously said when I previously covered this story, his girlfriend was riding on a scooter because she was injured, following John Crawford around Walmart. Now, if you or your girlfriend saw an armed, what you thought was an armed man in Walmart, threatening people with an assault rifle, would you let yourself or your girlfriend or anyone you know follow this dangerous individual around? Let alone when you're injured and can't run away that you have to use a device to get yourself around. So, we're going to play this video now. And it's disturbing. And there's little to no sound. The video that I am playing did match up the 911 dispatch call with the audio, although we're not sure. The prosecutor claims that it is synced because they claim that the audio matches the part where he was told to drop the rifle. But you can't tell because the surveillance video had no sound. So it's not sure because we're talking milliseconds here between the cops saying drop the rifle and them shooting. And whether he dropped the rifle before or after, again, this is a BB gun looking, this is a BB gun that looks like a rifle. They're not sure whether he dropped it before or after, but even then it doesn't matter. But I will play this video and we will, for the people listening to the audio only, I will narrate. Michael, turn up the Sam's.
You ready?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's play it. Ready?
Mm-hmm. It's playing.
Okay, so John Crawford, via the surveillance video, is walking into Walmart. He's clearly on the phone. His hand is to his head. One of his arms is to his head. He walks up to an aisle, and he picks up the Crossman MK-177, which is loose. It's a BB gun / pellet gun type device. Now, the video speeds up to show that he walks past people. And at no point do the people he walks past give him a second look. At no point do they run away from him. At no point do they feel threatened by him. The video sped up as he walks through all the different aisles in Walmart, the gun pointed down. Here he was walking into the final aisle before he is shot. He has the rifle. This is the first time I've seen him holding it up, leaned against his shoulder. You know, sort of like if you were a person from the 1920s walking around with a fancy cane and you put it up on your shoulder. That's literally how he's holding it, relaxed. Remember now, this Walmart's in Ohio, where it is completely legal for you to walk into Walmart and open carry. So he's standing in the aisle, gun pointed at nobody. We are watching a second camera view of the a door that's situated across from the aisle. So you'll be able to see the police approach him from the first camera view, and the one that's on John Crawford is where you will see him get shot. Again, children have walked by him. A mother and children have walked by him. They're in no rush. Okay, now here's where the 911 dispatch audio is attempted to be synced with the surveillance video that has no sound.
2026.
Okay, here comes the Beaver Creek, Ohio police. They shoot. John Crawford had dropped the rifle, and he sort of ducked out of the aisle into the area in between the aisle he was in and the aisle that's after it. He then comes running back into the aisle where he dropped the gun. I'm assuming he realizes now that the police were the ones who told him to drop the weapon and he's been shot. You could hear him screaming. He drops to his knees.
Gunshot to the store.
He's on the floor screaming and the police are yelling at him. I just want to play that one part right there where the police... I want you to watch the amount of time, whether or not he dropped the BB gun before the police said drop it or not. Would it have made a difference in the amount of time that they took to shoot him after or before making this command? And watch as he comes back to comply. He wants to... I realize now what's going on. My back was turned to you. I had no idea what was going on.
2026.
Just unbelievable. Again, here comes the police. Now watch the second camera. Don't pay attention to the first one. A shot. He falls. He gets back up and walks back into the aisle. Falls on his knees.
Gunshot to the store. Police officers are here. They're on the scene.
All right.
Yeah, thank God the police are on the scene to murder a young unarmed man. It's just unbelievable. You know, the police are the professionals here. They should have known to come in, see the situation, what's actually going on, and then alter what the phone call, what situation they prepared for via the 911 call, and then taking it from there. But at the same time, I can't help myself but say, this does not absolve the police of their wrongdoing whatsoever. They are 100% responsible for this man's death. But I don't see how someone cannot argue. How we at least can't have a jury decide whether this Ronald Ritchie, who is a white man, and his girlfriend are at least partly responsible for hyping up this situation and leading the police to this man's death. It's sickening. And this is on a day where in Ferguson, protests are erupting. This was yesterday again, the grand jury. And when this happened in Ferguson, where protests erupted because the Michael Brown memorial that was set up on the street where he was killed was burned down. And police showed up to not even look into the burnings of the memorial situation, but to rally to corral the protesters while the police are wearing "I am Darren Wilson" bracelets. Now, I don't know about you, but maybe that's not what you should be doing.
Maybe
when black men are being unarmed black men are being shot and killed across the country. Just unbelievable. No one is going to be responsible for John Crawford's death when there are literally at least four people I see who are two of them directly responsible for his death. The police and then the two who called the 911 hyping up the situation. That was nothing. Disgusting.
We're going to go to the fun half, where we have many fun things planned for you. Obviously, folks, becoming a member is every single day that I work in media, and anything related to this space, this model is amazing. I mean, even compared to a nonprofit model where you have to rely on a couple of high, you know, value donors, and I'm not saying there's plenty of other groups and organizations, and you know, we play a very particular role in this whole process, and obviously collaborate with other people, rely on other people. There's great work done, but the model that you literally fund this, you literally make this happen, is pretty amazing. So I would just encourage you, if you're listening to this show, and even if you're, you know, you're listening today, that means you not only love Sam, but you at least strongly like Matt and I. No, to become a member, and you should go, and you can do that. Go ahead, Matt.
You could do that,
yeah,
by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. It will take you right to the page where you can become a member. It's less than a cheap bodega coffee. You know, we're talking what
for both for people outside of New York City, that would be like a gas station coffee.
Yeah. Less than that a day.
Less than that a day.
You can also support this show by buying all of your stuff that you buy through Amazon through our Amazon link. You will notice no difference from buying it through the main Amazon.com URL. You will see the same page, the same site, the same products, the same prices. However, because Amazon sees that you were referred by us, they give us a little bit of a kickback, which is why you can go to that our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. Other ways to support this show is leaving us, and now this is very important, leaving us a iTunes review.
Yeah.
It's that simple. You go to you open up your iTunes, you search for the show, The Majority Report. We will pop up and just click add a review. You give the star review, you give a text, you know, write out a little text review. Just say what you like about the show. It helps us greatly rise in the iTunes ratings, which helps more people see our show. Also, follow us on Twitter at MajorityFM. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMajorityReport. Subscribe to our YouTube channel where we make video clips of the segments you hear on this podcast. It's a great way to share specific segments with your friends to get them turned on to the whole show. And that link is youtube.com/SamCedar. We also have a YouTube channel for the live video feed of the show, which is youtube.com/MajorityReportLive. If you like coffee, if you like chocolates, get them fair trade at justcoffee.coop. That's .coop. Use coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off your entire order. I mean, it's that simple, people. We're practically saving you money, and it's a way to support us. And it's really that simple.
It's all really that simple. The IMs are open. Join us that way, or you can call in 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We have plenty of great stories for you in the fun half of the show. See you on the flip side, members.